Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Oh, hello everyone, welcome back to the Disability Study channel on New Book Network. Today, I feel very happy to invite Dr. Saint-Pierre to introduce his newest book, Trip Talk. So first thing I want to invite Dr. Saint-Pierre to introduce yourself to our audience.
Hi, thank you, Shu, for having me. I'm really excited to be here. I'm Joshua Saint-Pierre. I'm Canada Research Chair in Critical Disability Studies and Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Alberta in Canada. So I'm pretty new in both of those posts, and it was challenging actually to try and start being a Canada research chair during COVID, but it's been going well so far.
Okay, thank you so much, Dr. Saint-Pierre. So my next question is that I want to invite you to talk about the reason you take interest in the promising field of disability studies.
So I didn't ever plan on this. This wasn't, it just kind of one of those things that happened to me. I actually went to, the story is I went to Bible school and planning to become a pastor, and then I found philosophy and got hooked on theory. And it was only when I moved to Edmonton to start my graduate studies that I just happened, just as these things go, to be at this place where there was a big research project going on this called Living Archives on Eugenics in Western Canada. And so it was both like telling the story of eugenics in Western Canada, but it's also really specific in its approach, and the concern for who tells these stories is actually really important. So anyway, so I hadn't ever thought about my speech, so I stutter even though I'm not stuttering much currently. But I had never thought of myself as disabled. I had never, understood what disability is really. But it was in that summer where I, all of a sudden it was was immersed in the history of eugenics in this province that I actually had grown up in, and I had no idea that there was this really ugly ableist history in my backyard. So I came to a disability community through a counter eugenic project, I guess. And for me, that's always what drives my interest in disability studies, is that when whatever we're talking about, whether it's stigma or accessibility utility. What we're talking about is the right or the capacity for disabled people to inherit the world. And it's the question, right, of like who is this world for? And especially against the history of eugenics, staking out a claim for disability and disabled bodies is, I think, an extremely important political investment right now.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Saint-Pierre. Thank you so much for your answer. So let's go to your book. So my first question is that I want to invite you to talk about how capitalism put speech to work and made it a low-cost string of labor and the human capital.
Yes. So this is, I guess, one of the driving questions of this project. And so I should say that this book is kind of funny in the sense that I started it. It was my PhD dissertation that then, you know, over years and years kind of became this weird thing. And then at the end of it, I had to turn into a book. So, you know, it's actually, you know, it's the weird thing of like, the book represents almost a decade of like, you know, thinking, and I and myself has changed in that whole time. Anyways, all to say that part of the driving force of this, of the book, has started with this question of how communication has been put to work within capitalist economies, and what new forms of, or not, I guess new modalities of ableism and disableism are born when communication and speech becomes really for the first time in history a generalized capacity that applies to the whole population, right? So the story I trace in the book is that you know, prior to the 19th century, having clear and efficient speech, what I call fluency, speech that doesn't have any tics or repetitions or slurs, but is perfect, as if this is possible, is perfectly rational and transparent, right, in its meaning. And up until the 19th century, being a good speaker was a more or less a specialized activity reserved for lawyers and priests and, you know, the politicians and stuff like this, right? Within the 19th century, there's this groundswell of social urgency that came around the idea that, hey, having a literate and articulate population in general is a good thing. And we can trace this with, you know, there's the Foucauldian story here of making everyday subjects more communicable and articulate is a way to overall increase the power that all these medicalized and other industries have over the biopolitical subject. So it was at the point when speech was both becoming an increased economic resource for the first time, that is to say, in so-called Fordist economies, right, there's relatively silent relationship within a system of production, because value is produced by the repetition of standardized motion, standing at an assembly line, and you didn't have to speak to be a valuable worker. But as there's these switches that start to happen in the early 20th century, where communication itself both becomes a valuable commodity that's being circulated in popular media, but it also communication networks also become really important to the internal workings of economic systems. So it isn't enough anymore just to work silently by yourself and do your own job. Being interactive with others on you know the factory floor is becoming more and more important, and this shift goes on until right now. You know, we can talk about, even though Fordism hasn't gone anywhere, in some ways it's been expanded in a post-Fordist economy, where we can think about all these gig workers like Uber drivers, you know, freelance copy editors, where it's information that's being traded on, and the speed of it is actually really important. And it was all to say that there's this whole process in which communication has become increasingly internalized within capitalism, and as that's happened, communication has become a problem, or in Foucauldian terms, it's been problematized such that the abnormal speaking subject both becomes a target of intervention for itself, right? Of trying to clear away all these impediments to a social field of good speakers. But the disabled speaker also becomes a target of medical scientific study to understand speech and how it works at a more and more intimate level, to try and optimize speaking patterns across the whole social body, whether or not someone identifies as disabled, right? And so that's in the book. I trace in this chapter the role that the industry of speech language pathology has played, and I argue that it's an industry of the means of production. So, as you know, like in a Fordist economy, an industry of the means of production would be that which produces the heavy implements, you know, like the very tools that industry is done with. In information economies, this work is taken up by therapeutic industries like speech language pathology.
Thank you so much, Dr. Sampir. I really appreciate your answer. So my next question, I want to invite you to talk about how the control over process and act of communication via the filtering of unwanted and dangerous noise from the medium of communication rely on depoliticalization of both noise and disability that render communication inert.
Thank you for the question. I may repeat it because I recognize that that's like a big question to try and for people to get their hands on. Let me answer, I guess, just by giving a bit of context to chapter two. So if chapter one was tracing the history of one historic technology and formation of power over the speaking body, that is speech language pathology, the second chapter takes up the question of another formation of power over the speaking body in the 20th century, and that's information and communication technologies. So a lot of my interest here is the way in which I guess typically humanistic concerns have been translated into technical and systems theory frameworks, and what gets flattened out in that translation. Here, one of the people that's interesting is like mid-century cyberneticians had a lot of faith in the power of communication, and partly that faith was tied up in Cold War sentiments, right? And this idea that if liberal democracies are defined constitutively by free flow of information, right? There's not state, ostensibly there's not like state hierarchies that are feeding propaganda, and citizens have good information to make the best use, the best choices. And so it was in this term, in this time, that like a lot of values like freedom became translated into information systems framework, where the question here is not sort of, when it comes to information theory, the semantic a meaning of a phrase is always secondary. What a phrase means in the end is secondary to the technical problem of contact and establishing a clean channel of transmission. From what I understand, and I don't understand the maths here, how information is understood is a matter of probability, right? And so, but there's two kinds of probability that emerge and are thought of differently. So there's the good probability of, and that's what liberal agency is concerned with, right? The probability of a speaker could actually say any different number of things, and that undecidability is the very metric of human agency, right? So that's good uncertainty, but there's also this bad uncertainty that were things like stuttering. It's all this background noise that has to be treated as background noise in order for the channel to protect the good uncertainty of the speaker. And the problem is that this bad uncertainty, it frays the edges of the channels, and so it makes it actually unclear at times what is a message and what is a noise, or what is an intentional a message, and what was something that was unintentional that slipped in via bad uncertainty, right? So there's always there's this problem of like, how do we screen away this bad uncertainty to make space for information to be transferred in a clear and unambiguous problem, right? And so one of the things that's interesting then is, as information theory and its logic become more entangled with Western governance and governmentality, as the flow of communication becomes more and more important to the operation of power, the interruption of communication itself again becomes an even bigger threat, right? And it's such that Donna Haraway said that, quote, the biggest threat to power is the interruption of communication. One of the things that's really tricky or sneaky about information theory, I think, is the way in which noise becomes an almost inherently depolitical thing, right? We're just talking about the efficiency of technical channels at a certain point. And within that context, they would say, like, right, well, who wants to have a stuttering Zoom call, right? Like even in like this interview now, right? They would say, well, noises is the universal enemy. And I mean, I get that in a way, but also there's this concerning way in which there's also this long history of specific bodies being coded themselves as noisy, and those kinds of judgments aren't going anywhere. Like all that's doing is that they're being like swallowed into a larger system, and it's becoming harder to actually name, what the harm is, right? Of just wanting fluency, right? And I get it. There's something about like in which communication has become this unassailable good that anytime you question the value of fluency, the thought is that that you're just like, you're a bull in the china shop, right? But the point that I think that the book is making is that there's actually a much wider range in which we can communicate and relate to each other. And infocapitalism, and while it certainly increases the pace and the rate in which we communicate, giving us and inciting more and more opportunities to speak our minds, to give feedback, right? The kinds of enunciations which are allowed to exist in the world is becoming increasingly narrow, and that's partly because of the ways in which noise is being depoliticized and filtered out.
Okay, thank you, Dr. St. Pierre. Thanks so much for your answer. So let's turn to the next question. I want to invite you to talk about the definition and the function of the talking head.
Sure. So the talking head is it's kind of a cheeky term that I came up with to describe a more than what it typically denotes, I think, right? So within, right, the common understanding, the talking head is like the shot from like the shoulders up of just the shoulders and a head in frame, and is usually meant to convey information in a very direct and immediate way, but especially in an age of punditry and YouTube stars, talking heads, they also have, it's not just that, right? And they also, have become a kind of entity in their own right within infocapitalism. In a lot of instances, a talking head is taken to be an expert, a rational expert who can just say things as they are. But in other instances, right, talking heads, unlike we think of like Twitch or YouTube streamers, where their existence online is as a talking head, but their role isn't to inform as an expert, you know, as much as it is to entertain, I guess, in a sense, right? So thinking about like what is it that is common to this idea talking head, in the book, I think I define it as a machine that forms connections with others. Excuse me. A machine that forms connections with other semiotic components. It relays information to form connections. So one way to think about it is a talking head is a connection, a machine that aims to maximize its communicative contact. Right. So
Okay, thank you so much for your...
Yeah, oh, it's okay if I can tune a little bit. So that's kind of what it does. But on the other part of the question is, what is the function of a talking head, right? And here, well, here there's a lot to say, but in the book, I float this idea that there's a priestly element to what the talking head does, and so I mean, and there's an argument to be made in that that's both cybernetics was a kind of information revolution, greatly akin, I think, to the Protestant Reformation in the attempt to abolish hierarchies of who has access to information. And so there's this idea that came with the internet and the World Wide Web that was premised, I think, on, you know, equality of access to information for all, right? And in some ways, I think one can understand the talking head as being part of this new priestly class, right? Of being part of an information where we all share in this responsibility of having access to information. Of course, there's that's not the whole story, and there's all kinds of ways in which these claims to universal access and equality are actually covering over all kinds of hierarchies of power and who has access to be heard and who has access to agency. But at least on paper, this idea that the talking head can save us, because if we can all just speak our truths loud enough, then and get our message understood, then, you know, we can bring about social justice. And so I'm not trying to I'm not trying at all to undercut the claim to speak truth to power. What I am worried about is the ways in which infocapitalism has been set up to absorb our speaking truth to power as part of its operating mechanisms. So it's really, really good at absorbing people speaking out for all kinds of reasons. So so the talking head it plays an important, I could argue, I would argue political function, but I worry that critical communities sometimes place too much hope on the power of the talking head.
Okay, thank you so much for your answer, so Dr. Saint-Pierre. So my last question today is that I want to invite you to talk about how the different speaker, the talking head, and the troll influence political actions.
Yeah. Thank you for this question. So I think that there's a way in which the talking head and the troll are two sides of the same coin of political action. So talking heads and trolls is what we get when we have reduced communication to its neoliberal form of, you know, of human capital. And when we reduce speech, not just to human capital, but to the logic of capital itself, talking heads and trolls are what we get, right? And in some ways, it's like, it's not surprising after like tracing all this history of us continually reducing communication from a relational to a transactional activity. It turns out that the kind of action it inspires is also very transactional as well. And so, I mean, I don't want to get into too much theory at the very end of the interview, but all to say is that I think that the talking head, the troll, and the disciplined speaker, and they all kind of model a different kind of what the Greeks called parrhesia, or which also is translated as honest speech, as courageous speech, as frank speech. But there's a way in which this is, right, the courage to stand up in the assembly. And here we have ableist assumptions of who can stand. But to speak and to stake one's to stake oneself to their enunciation, even to the point of death, as for Socrates, right? And so there's this ongoing question of what does free, courageous speech that speaks truth to power look like? And for some people, like, there's the Platonic tradition has answered the question that that true or that honest speech is speech that is spoken by a purified body that totally encapsulates reason and speaks as a quote unquote vessel of truth. And this is the gambit that the talking head makes, right? And they try to enter discourse within a field of equality, and to keep the field of equality as is, but just to gain as much attention as you can, right? Anyways, there's limits, I think, to thinking about political action for disabled people in terms of equality and representation. Insofar, I mean, and part of these reasons is that there's ways in which being always forced to play on the terms of the able-bodied is not a sustainable move for crip culture as we know, right? While it's true that talking heads are always going to be important allies for disability communities, I'm interested in asking what other forms of agency are there for disabled folk that don't turn upon our capacity to be representable as fluent, coherent beings, right? It's when our access to even be a political agent depends upon first our capacity to speak in a certain way, or even to speak at all, right? Then surely there's deep problems with how agency has been conceived, and I really think that there's something about the materiality of the stuttering body that has important political lessons it can teach.
Okay, thank you so much, Dr. St. Pierre. Thank you so much for your introduction, the discussion of your fantastic book. So at the end of our episode today, I want to talk to our audience. So as a disability historian, I highly recommend anybody with strong interest in disability study, in communication study, to consider buy a copy of Dr. St. Pierre's newest book, Trip Talk. It's a fantastic book. Thank you so much.